Anything we ought to check before we begin?
Yes, teacher, can we take class outside?
Wouldn't that be nice?
You'd be too distracted though.
Yeah, I was up this morning early, it was wonderful. I want to begin with this diagram, which is slightly a quick review of one point, and then to move us on. A couple of sessions.
Excuse me, but if that current writing back of you were drawn, and they do draw, I think you could see. Thank you.
Does that help?
That's great.
Okay. I want to rehearse this a bit. Am I going to block anybody's view like this? Okay. I had said a couple of sessions ago that the key switch was from this top line. I should make clear that that's a movement. From the top line to the next line over a process of about 1,000 years. And this norm, a patrilineal, androcentric, heterosexual, dominical understanding of power, this norm yields difference as degrees of separation. That was drawing on the Judith Plasko point. And the extreme of separation is opposition. And that's the extreme form of dualism then. And that dualism is expressed in many ways, male over female, God over humans, heaven, earth, etc. And this norm entails, then, categories such as homosexual, bisexual, transsexual, and heterosexual. That is, these terms make sense only in that normative system. And my question for today, one of the questions, is what if we just call ourselves sexual instead of heterosexual, homosexual, bisexual, transsexual? Just drop those categories. And all of us are sexual. And in that understanding, difference does not then alienate. Difference is celebrated rather than used as a reversion to dominical power again. Lording it over power is what dominical power means, lording it over. So that's the question for today. And in order to get at that, I'm going to talk for a while and then move us into some either small or large group discussion according to the preference of the assembled. If I ever win the lottery in Massachusetts, I'm going to donate more powerful lights to Holden Village Fireside Room. I just find it so sort of dim in here. But I would like to ask you to think and or write, but certainly think for just a minute before we begin about the following. If you were to walk down the street and discover walking toward you a person who looked identical to you, so that you were meeting yourself coming to you, what would be your immediate response to that person's body? Clear?
Do I look like that?
So, think, and if you need to, write about that just a bit. The question is, for those who just came in, if you were walking down the street and saw coming toward you yourself, what would be your reaction to that person's body? And do you think you'd be sexually turned on? Okay. I'm going to erase some of this in a minute, so if there's anything you want to write down about that, do it now, because I need some space there in just a minute. In the discussion of sexuality these days, one of the big questions was mentioned in that first video on dress codes. You remember the woman from Los Angeles who did all the photographs of her dyke friends? And she said her friends aren't interested in the academic discussion of what constitutes queer. They're interested in being it, she said. But there is a big discussion going on, not simply about what constitutes homosexuality or being gay or lesbian, but what constitutes sexuality, period. And that debate takes two... Can I help clarify something going on there? Okay. That debate is often expressed with two phrases, which I've mentioned before. And those phrases are social constructionism and essentialism. Social constructionism and essentialism. Social constructionism says that the meaning of sexuality is created in each historical period according to the needs and interests of a community of people. The meaning of sexuality is created in a given historical period according to the needs and interests of a group of people, and that includes what we usually call in this norm heterosexuality and homosexuality, so that they are created according to various needs and interests. Essentialism says that regardless of historical variation and interpretation, there is a core identity of the self, and for many people today, both those who are homophobic thoroughly and those who aren't, that essential core includes sexual attraction. So that even though men no longer wear the big wigs that Hogarth painted and were used in dress codes, an essentialist would say that men may change from dresses to slacks, from wigs to no wigs, but there's still a core of masculine identity. And essentialists would say that sexual core includes erotic preference. Social constructionists, the strict ones, would say you can change your erotic preference from time to time. And you may be for 10 years attracted to your own sex, so-called own sex, and then you may 10 years be attracted to a different sex. And that's the debate between the social constructionists and the essentialists. Now, I want to suggest a model which can, I hope, get us away from what I think is an irresolvable debate that gets us basically nowhere because it asks the wrong questions. So I want to pose a different model. And the model is a spiral of community. The old model talks about autonomous selves located around, and then you attribute an essential identity to this self. And the self might move through history with this identity, keeps going along. And in the old model, God is out here somewhere operating on these people. My model poses a visual interpretation of self that is quite different. It won't look like a human figure because I can't draw well enough to do this. But on this spiral, you place the various characteristics that have been understood to constitute a person. Body, emotion, spirit. Now I want to start visualizing something else. My spiral is a sphere, and that sphere is rolling as it's spiraling along. So this is not a two-dimensionality, this is three dimensions. So emotion can be any place in that sphere, inside it, on the surface. Body can be inside it, on the surface. And we add, I'm going to ask your help in a second here, other characteristics of what we usually call a person. Mind, what else goes in here? Body.
Feelings,
another part of emotion. Well, let's add them. What else?
Personality?
Senses?
Senses. What else?
Sexual identity.
Sexual identity. What else makes a person?
Relational. Somehow the relational part of our mind.
Right. And what kinds?
Well, with everything.
Okay, but everything needs names.
Every living creature, but probably with a person with the, you know, the other relationship with the other.
Okay, I'm going to every living creature. I want to add rocks. Anything else? Yeah, of course there are.
It's our ability to reflect, but I don't know.
Okay, that might be.
That makes us a person other than different from the animal.
How about saying that the ability to reflect happens when all of this spirals in a certain way?
Okay?
Okay, I need to add, for my own understanding of what constitutes a person, ritual. I need to put something back here. I need to put two spiraling systems that represent parents, at least egg and sperm origin that constitute self, and then all the complexities that would be family. That is part of myself. That's not prior to myself. That's part of what the self is. And we need things like religion. We need capitalism for most of the selves in this room, etc. Those all are constitutive of the person. And that's very different from the model that says you've got this self who sort of lives in a capitalist system, but is really abstractable from it. Or a self who lives in the ELCA. Or the Roman Catholic Church, but really is sort of separable from it. This model says that the self is a community. The self is a community. And it is constituted by other communities, as well as characteristics that seem more located in itself. Then, if we say, what is being sexual? For such a view of self, we are far beyond the use of vagina and penis. They aren't excluded, but to be sexual is as to be religious, or to be economic, or to be artistic. Those phrases always refer to the total self viewed from a particular perspective. The total self viewed from a particular perspective. Sexual, in other words, is all of this in a certain viewpoint. And it may be a viewpoint which, by emphasizing eros, say, that is this unitive love, highlights the self with a certain, like a certain filter, a certain lens. But I might be being most sexual in the sense of expressing unitive love when I'm photographing Bonanza Peak this morning at 7 a.m. For me, that was an immensely erotic act that is, by virtue of being erotic, sexual, and it was a tremendously community act rather than an autonomous self standing there with the camera pointing. There was, the phenomenon was this in relationship to the Northern Cascades. And that is a very different way of posing the issue of sexual ethics from the way that the church has posed it, which is usually the way of legalism. I want to talk just a bit more about that. This, I want to underline that this is constantly in motion. I want to make very clear, this is a very active process. And if we stop now, we would have to take every element of the relationship side and build in complexifying spirals for that. Imagine in the ELCA, for example, this is Elizabeth, and then there's Jeff Johnson in San Francisco, and then there's Herb Chilstrom, and then there's the Augsburg Confession, which feeds into all of this. So it's that, it's my insistence on the self as community, which I think can open up the falseness of dualistic options of heterosexual and homosexual. This is moving then towards sexual ethics characterized by something other than legalism. And I want to draw on an essay by James Nelson that is, I realize I don't have that book on here yet, that has recently been published in an anthology of essays on religion and health. And in that essay, he defines legalism as follows. He says, legalism is the attempt to apply precise rules and objective standards to whole classes of actions without regard to their unique contexts or the meanings of those or the meanings those acts have to particular persons. Objective standards and precise rules don't fit here, because if this is taken really seriously, and I don't want to, this is going to be way too individualistic unless I just visually do this. This is part of this group this morning, for example. At a certain point, this will be God. In the old model, God is out here still, outside this whole process, intervening with rules and regulations based on objective standards. This new model says you cannot find a place in the universe, even that part of it we know in community, which is apart from God. God always operates interiorly in the system, not from outside. And the price of that is that God is immersed in human life. And as a Lutheran, I think this is utterly marvelous, because it says, as Luther always said, it is the finite that contains the infinite. You do not look like outside finitude in order to find God. And this is, remember, these spirals are the people last night. This is we as we talked last night. And that's still where God is. God is not outside that agony that we talked about last night, but rather at certain moments in that agony, someone names and says, this is God. And we can talk about that in more detail, I hope, in just a bit. I want to say a couple of other things. Nelson says that as an alternative to sexual ethics as legalistic ethics, we ought to opt for an ethics that focuses on love. So what else is new? But love in the sense that he means it is this kind of love, love as communion, and now we need to start talking about what that consists in. This is love which includes erotic love, as we'll see in just a second. Communion is, Nelson claims, and I agree with him, a goal for which all human beings yearn. We are not built to be isolated absolutely. We are creatures who, even though it's tremendously difficult, ache for intimate communion with something in that is nonviolent in response to us. I think that's, by the way, one of the reasons that many women find that communion in nature, because nature is not violent, intentionally violent in response to that yearning. Nelson says that one of the most difficult impediments to obtaining this communion is that we are very anxious and afraid of our bodies, our own bodies. And I don't know what you wrote when I asked you to write what you would think meeting yourself, but for many people, in real honesty, we really do not sit comfortably in the body that we have. Not only sit comfortably, but with passionate delight in it. And that kind of, if one is without that passionate delight, it's very difficult to obtain communion. Communion will probably be unjust dependence under the guise of romantic love and not really communion. Nelson says that what I just called unjust dependence, he uses the word control. And then we're back to the power issue again. In response to anxiety and fear with regard to one's own body, the likely response is to try to control, to use dominating power again. Now, I want to turn in one final segment here before I open this up for our participation, for your participation as well, talking is listening. I want to add one list of factors that I think can move us in the direction of a people-friendly sexual ethics. And I begin by drawing on one item from the Janus Report again. They found in the period between the early 80s and the end of the 80s, a dramatic increase in interest in religion as it affects family life. People were very, very interested in finding religion that was compatible with their family life, thinking it essential for family well-being. But in their shopping around from religion to religion, they weren't looking for a set of rules that they would then fit their lives to. They're shopping around for religion that matches the rules that they have already chosen for their sexuality. So religions that want to concoct a new set of rules are just missing the boat on this one, even though I think it is obligatory for religious traditions to try to define what sexual communion might actually look like. So there's probably the hope that if a denomination does come up with it, like a social statement, that maybe it will indeed be compatible with human needs in the late 20th century. We'll have to see. But my question in regard to that is, can religion articulate the practical qualities of the communions of love? Can religion articulate the practical qualities of communions of love? And I want to pose to you seven characteristics of such a communion, of such communions, not because I think they are universal moral standards, although I might even indeed want to argue that at some point, but because I think they can be helpful in articulating a new sexual ethics. And they won't be surprising by and large. They will be drawing together some of these strands from these sessions. The first two go together, and on three of these I'm drawing on some of Nelson's work, which many of you will recognize, Nelson and others. The first two go together. The first quality here of a new sexual ethic would be that it is non-dualistic. That's self-evident by this point, I hope. And the second characteristic is that it is body positive. There's something additional that needs to be said, though, for that. The non-dualism here is the dualism of spirit and body, which says you may do anything to your body because it's really the spirit that's the important thing religiously. Unfortunately, some of our hymns in Holy Week are just loaded with this dualism. Terrible stuff, actually, I think. But on the other hand, it's all symbolic. That's a passion struggle for Holy Week. Spirit and body, in these two first qualities of this ethic, are not, on the old model, separable entities somehow that are in competition. Body and spirit are two names for the same reality viewed from two different perspectives. Body and spirit are names for the same reality, for one reality, viewed from two different perspectives. Instead of two realities, sort of glued together with super glue temporarily, because they are really alien and don't belong together. That's the old model. The new sexual ethic refuses to separate, and this, even for analytical purposes here, these terms are put in different places, but if you keep in mind that this is a sphere and moving, there is no place in this sphere which is not body. And there is no place in this sphere which is not mind. If you watch the, well, some of you couldn't, you're here, but the Bill Moyers series on the, using the mind to heal the body was just spectacular in this regard, because it completely rejected mind-body dualism. And Bill Moyers, in certain points, had a hard time gearing up to this, even though he's tried manfully, as we say, because he still kept thinking that it's the mind that controls the body in a dualistic sense, instead of the mind being located completely throughout the body. And I think we tend to think that the mind is still in the brain, exclusively. And the wonderful conversation that took place in this series was that the mind is as much in the big toe as it is in the brain, because mind pervades body, and body embodies all of mind, which is a struggle. And it's wonderful for opening up sexuality. So that's the first two, is non-dualistic with regard to spirit and body positive. But understanding that these terms refer to persons in this new way. Parenthetically, Rosemary Ruther has a nice passage on this in Sexism and God Talk on the new versions of spirit and body language. The third characteristic is one I have of this new sexual ethic, is one that I have mentioned already, and that is that the well-being of women and children are as important as the well-being of men. It seems sort of obvious that one would say that, until you remember that the whole history of Western tradition has worked to deny that in Christian sexual ethics. The fourth characteristic of this new people-friendly sexual ethics would be that both sameness and difference are construed as positive. Both sameness and difference are construed as positive. By that I mean that we will move away from difference as alienation, but we will not assume that difference is the only good. It's okay to be the same. And that would be very dangerous to say if we didn't simultaneously say it's okay to be different. This is putting heterosexual and homosexual in different language and thereby changing its meaning completely, I hope. But we'll see if that works in a minute. The fifth characteristic of this new direction is to say that love includes eros as well as agape, to use those funny words. Some of you know that for most of post-World War II, Protestant theology anyhow, there was no place for eros in Christian love. Eros was understood as too interested. Agape is when you love somebody regardless. It doesn't matter who that person is, which I think is just about the worst form of love. To say that God loves me regardless of who I am is really, I find, just deadening, because it says that it doesn't, that I really sort of disappear. I'm sort of an anonymous self, because it's not the qualities of me that makes God love me at all. It's what I'm not. that is, I'm in my not-sinness is what God loves. So it's a strange idea that we've fallen into here, this disinterested love notion. In this new model, eros as this desire for union, and agape as loving even what is, by the dominant ideology, unlovable. That would be a way to keep agape in there. And the love of friends. And, however this gets put together, self-love are all positively included. In the new model, loving oneself is utterly essential. And we've got, that's, I think, one of the biggest changes for us, because we've been often taught that to sacrifice oneself, to hate oneself, is the epitome of Christian faithfulness. So the new model is says that love, rather than being simply agape, disinterested, passionless love, love too is a community of forms of love. And the sixth characteristic is that sexual passion and sensuality are expressions of faith in God. Sexual passion and sensuality are expressions of faith in God. So that orgasm is as much an expression of faith as prayer is. Which isn't exactly what I learned in confirmation class. I'm going to think about it. There has been a tendency, and here I think James Nelson is very helpful in this. There has been a tendency to move in the direction of positive evaluation of sexuality on sort of an interpersonal level in this new ethic, but still keep the spiritual realm, the realm of religious ritual, as largely asexual still. It doesn't really have an erotic component to it. And I think that we're just then ratifying dualism in a new way if we use that. So the insistence that our religious lives be fully sensual, and indeed that our sexuality be an expression of our religious lives, that emphasis, I think, is taking it to the sufficient expression of sexuality and spirituality. And the final aspect of my list is that the intimate and the public are one reality viewed from two standpoints. The intimate and the public are one reality viewed from two standpoints. We tend to divide intimate expression and public expression in a fairly dualistic fashion, too. And that means that we have the very, very painful conversations of bringing to public discourse what has been experienced as private and intimate. In this model, what is public and what is intimate depends upon how you are viewing the same experience. They aren't two realities. So what you are doing in the so-called privacy of the bedroom is a public phenomenon with public import, and vice versa. What is done by the Congress is intimate in that it is inextricable from what two men are doing in Alabama, for example, to use the ruling that the Supreme Court made in the 70s or 80s, 70s I think, that says that sodomy is not protected by the Constitution. Now, if we put all those together, we would have a delicious mess that would mean we would have no fast way of categorizing large patterns of behavior as moral or immoral. Rather, we would have to pay attention to the particular community context in which we are living. Not somebody else's, but actually investigate the experience of the community for whom we are deliberating, with whom we are deliberating morally. In this system, I hope it would be clear, it would not be possible to say Make sure I can believe this. It would not be possible to maintain patriarchal heterosexism as the moral norm for the whole community. I'm going to stop there and check where we are. We have 45 minutes. And I want to find out whether you want... I'm thinking that small group work is a good idea, but I want to check that.
I think if we do small group, we miss your input, which is quite enlightening.
Yeah, but fewer people get to talk. It's a trade-off, I think. But it's up to the group. What do you want to do?
What about 15 minutes in small groups and 30 minutes in back and forth?
What about that? 15 and 30? It's okay? In the small groups, let me offer a possibility which you can do or not, completely up to you. Take a look at what you wrote or thought about at that beginning about meeting yourself, coming and going, as phrases now. I have been in conversations lately with friends and students at Harvard and at Women's Theological Center, and various people are arguing that the root of homophobia is when you're in my model this morning, you're walking down the street, you see yourself coming, and you can't stand it. That you don't like the person coming toward you, that physical body coming toward you, and find it about the least sexually turning on reality around. Thesis, that is. Hypothesis. So that you might talk about in the small groups, if you're inclined. In fact, I like that a lot. Now, the more I think about that, it's a very intriguing way to put this. So that's a possibility. Or you can talk about some of this. Is this just malarkey, or does it help you understand what it means to be a person? Or you can talk about whatever your heart's desire for 15 minutes. Is that okay to go with it that much, with that much specificity? I don't know, your bodies are really weird this morning. I have a hard time reading this group. Okay.
Processing.
Okay. Well, thanks, because I probably forget that part.
Mine being in the big toe, because the Greeks at one time believed that the mind was in the heart, and that they knew the mind was essential, and so they figured, you know, it had to be in the heart. Because when they received wounds to the head, it wasn't always fatal, but a wound to the heart was always fatal. So they figured the mind must be there, and I've always kind of liked that idea that the mind was in the heart.
Yeah. Well, if it's in the whole body, it's in the heart, but not only in the heart. Which, food for thought. Okay, let's take 15 minutes in small groups, construct them according to whatever criterion moves you at the moment. But just make sure that nobody's left out. ...that I should have made, and I keep remembering it belatedly every time I do this, and probably for experiential reasons. This kind of model I just love. I can go with flux and chaos and indeterminate change, all that stuff forever. But for some persons who have experienced serious abuse, establishing boundaries is utterly crucial for well-being. And I want to make clear that I'm not trying to eliminate that from this model. That this doesn't mean complete amorphous sort of no focus, no identity. It means a very complicated identity, but it doesn't say that there is no difference, again, between selves and among selves. And I thought maybe doing a squiggle line through the middle of this might, for those who believe in the essential self theory, you can sort of represent it that way. And the second thing, I overheard some conversation about this. I thought it was very helpful to point out the problems of possessive language about body. It's like the detachable penis. Most of us have learned detachable body. That we have our, there's myself, and then there's the body that I happen to inhabit at the moment. That is my body language. If only my body didn't let me down, language. And I thought maybe it would be nice if we switched that language and tried to say, every time instead of my body, say I body, and make that identification of self-body, or even more complicatedly, we body. One of the reasons I stopped smoking years ago was when it really finally dawned on me that as a feminist believing this we body, I just could not keep subjecting other people, other dimensions of my body called other people, to that smoke. Now, what? So a couple of qualifications there. What emerged in your groups? Anything interesting? You seem to be bubbling away in conversation, I assume. We have two tasks left. Yes, Verlin, go ahead.
Well, we were talking in our group, and we were saying how if we had adopted this motto wholeheartedly, we just have so much to lose. Our life is so much based on the, and I'm not sure what the word you used about it, monogamous, heterosexual.
We can even go further. We can call it heteropatriarchal monogamy.
Yeah, okay. So much of our life is based on the heteropatriarchal monogamy.
Let's call it HPM.
So much of our life is based on the HPM that it would just be almost self-destructive to adopt this 100% or even parts of it. You don't even have to go 100%, really. And so we were saying how we thought it was scary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just an aside from that, we were talking about your thing about self-love, and some of the people we have the hardest time with are the people who we think love themselves too much. And we were all sort of taught to be humble. That sort of, and so those are some things.
Okay. I like that first point, because I think what it suggests is that this entails conversion. And I think there's a lot of useful stuff in Scripture then about exactly what the scope of this would be in terms of giving up.
I had a question about, I like the way that, I'm kind of a linear, well, I guess I'm a very linear person. I like the idea of a line going through that spiral. I think my question, we kind of talked about in our group, the idea of, right or wrong, immoral, moral, immoral, the idea of boundaries, who and how are they set? Are they set situationally? Or, is there some boundary line, or, because the idea is we're moving away from the legalistic top down, so where do the new definitions of, I guess, right or wrong, or do we even use that anymore? I don't know.
Well, I think you would first have to say that the deciders of right and wrong are going to be different in this model. So that you would not have, in one sense, you'd go back to Aquinas, oddly enough, and you would say that those who are most affected by a policy, you would most ensure to be participating in forming that policy. Which I think is a wonderful principle in ethics. So that if the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America is going to have a policy on the ordination of what are now called gay men and lesbians, then it would be untenable for that policy to be set up without the full participation of gay men and lesbians in the ELCA. If you're going to have a policy on the disciplining of children, you would not set up that policy without the full participation of the children. If you have a policy on how the district attorney's office is going to handle reports of so-called domestic violence, you would make sure that that policy is set up in the DA's office with the full participation of women and men who have been both perpetrators and victims of domestic violence, et cetera. So that, and I don't think that's any more complicated than what we do now, actually. I mean, people often say, oh, that's not efficient, you can't da-dum, da-dum. Well, efficiency now is at the cost of immense pain. So that's a start. Does that at all pacify your linear?
I'd like to ask, as I see this, it didn't come to mind until now, but this is similar to the medicine wheel, in that there is the four directions, but there's a spiral in the four directions too that they have. So people might be interested in further study of the medicine wheel, because I think it really has a real depth, and it touches upon the earth a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's not patriarchal.
There's also a very serious conversation going on among feminists about how we interact with traditions that are different from ours. So that when white women use Alice Walker's discussion of between Shug and Seeley in The Color Purple, as if it were the only theological insight that African American women had ever had, I mean, quoting it beyond limit, without any address, really, of our own racism as white women. That's been the name these days in the conversation is that is appropriation of somebody else's material. And I think there's a real struggle going on now. How do we move away from imperialism of our own culture without just being imperialistic again and taking whatever we want from other cultures as if they were just transportable parts? So I think I find Native American traditions marvelously healthy in many respects, but I always have to come back and say, hold it a second, Elizabeth. What was it you did in relationship to Rosebud in South Dakota when you were growing up? And so it's, I appreciate your insight there, and just want to add the other side to it, that it always has to be addressed from the question of the power of the dominant group. So, on so-called race, so-called gender, all that borrowing is a big power question, first of all.
I like the self and community image, and it seems to me that it doesn't fit in Christianity. And I'm wondering why, you know, I don't think that I can ever not call myself a cultural Christian, because I've been raised in the Christian church. It's always going to affect me. But why should I choose to be a part of that group if it's not working for me? If it's patrilineal, androcentric, heterosexual, and why? I mean, I guess I see no reason, and you know, that kind of relates, you know, when I look to other traditions to try and get some spiritual community.
Do you, let me clarify, make sure I understand what you're asking. Are you asking, your question in response to what I just said about appropriation? Or are you worrying, about something else?
No, I guess my question is more, it's not focused on the appropriation, it's focused on, you know, if this isn't working, and this is being, if Christianity isn't working for me, and it's oppressing me, then why deeper. I mean, and maybe that, you know, you probably can't answer that for me, I'm going to answer, but I would like to hear other people say, and if other people feel that way.
Well, I certainly could talk at length about that one, but maybe it wouldn't be best if I started that response. How about others starting the response? Because it certainly is not, you are not idiosyncratic in that question.
I would just say that I have never bought the whole box of Catholicism. And so I have, when I was younger, I did. But as I got older, I a bunch of this stuff is just the, you know, so I didn't, you know, I went along, and I had to search my own soul. And so I didn't buy the whole thing, and I still don't.
But why do you buy some of it?
Because it's truth. just as part of the Quran, part of all the Indian spirituality, and the reason that I see value in like the Indian spirituality is that I see truth there. And truth, I think, is the same in East India as it is in New York, as it is in, you know, in Canada. Truth is truth. And so that's why, maybe because of communication in this vast and developing world, that a new religion is forming that touches upon all the truths of all time.
The question that she poses, though, you know, I think that one of the reasons that Christianity is frequently not appealing to the masses, whether you're talking about the United States or whatever, is that it doesn't hit at the core of what is real, maybe, for them. And for those of us that are here, we probably have accepted, you know, either the ritual or some aspect of Christianity that speaks to us. But when we wonder why our churches are not thriving or whatever, I think it is because that a lot of people are struggling with that very issue about Christianity.
I was never raised in a church. I didn't grow up with the tradition in the Sunday school. And my belief of the world always followed along more this model than the patriarchal hierarchical model. And the only definition of Christianity I had been exposed to was this fundamental patriarchal view. And it wasn't until, you know, after college that I started seeing other interpretations of Christianity. And my belief is what is expressed in Christ's teachings is very much in agreement with this type of a model, and it's the organized religion, the organization of the churches that has taken Christianity and made it into a patriarchal line. But that's not what the root of Christianity is about.
I guess I can't see separating. I mean, I'm kind of playing devil's advocate here, but I can't see separating. You know, especially if we're going with this model, if Christianity, if you're saying that Christianity is in line with this model that you feel that the root of Christianity agrees with this model, then it would have to agree with the history of Christianity. Does that make sense? It would have to be incorporating the patriarchal and heterosexual things because they are all spirals going into each individual spiral. So it's impossible to separate them for me to separate that. I guess I struggle with sitting in church and having to separate out in my mind, okay, this is my Christianity, but this is the one actually that we're talking about right now. You know, this is the one that actually the creed is saying, so, but I'll say a different creed that I make up.
So your options, I think, are fairly clear, though, and there's a long, long history of saying this particular incarnation of truth, if you use this, is no longer tolerable, and I will initiate with my friends in faith
a new incarnation of it, which has happened repeatedly throughout the history of Christianity and other religions. So you get this multi, and especially in the United States, I mean, it's just the going thing to do. 300 major expressions of Christian faith. How many different diversities can we get? So I think it's a real struggle for, the struggle is located in asking whether the place to fight is within a particular incarnational form of the church, or to try to find another one. And it's not as if we were, as if there were a choice between two planets. There's still going to be connections between those two activities, because you can't get out of this. You can't go someplace which is totally free of John Paul II or Herb Gilstrom. It's not possible. And fortunately, those two guys have to say the same thing about Elizabeth Bettenhausen. They can't get away from her either. And the rest of us. So, but there are, I think that there are differences of particular selves, and that each of us eventually will have to come to a conclusion daily as to where we're joining this. I really agree that this model is as ancient a Christian model as the other H whatever acronym we develop now. That, and for me, part of the reason to hang in there to some degree, varying depending, is that I don't want to let the patriarchs completely eliminate this model. Which is what I think really what a battle is right now. But that's, I'm not saying that all women ought to do that, because I think it is tremendously painful to hang in there. And I'm not in the business of saying you ought to be pained.
You know, we were talking here about, I'm here for the purpose, I had a chance to come, but I prayed that God would help me find myself. And so we mentioned that, and here's this younger girl that she wonders who she is. And I think we all struggle with it. Look, I'm much older than she is, and I'm still struggling with it. And she's struggling, too. And, you know, and that spiral, you know, and I think that's great. Because I just added, when you made that spiral, we had to make a map of hell or something like that for our retreat. And so you know what I did? I made a spiral. I made one for my husband and one for me, because that was an alcoholic marriage. And it was bad. It was bad. And I felt like I was in a cocoon and I wanted to get out. So I figured, I didn't know how to draw cocoons, so I made those spirals. And I made one for my husband, and he too was struggling with that. And all of a sudden, the cocoon opened and two butterflies came out. And it was beautiful at the time, you know, but we still, and I'm still struggling to find out who I am. But we had when you said conversion, right away when I had drawn those butterflies, that was a conversion for us, because we had come out of that struggle and we tried, are continuing trying to fly on. So because all this in the alcoholic marriage, you know, that I was the worst person that was created, you know. And he told me, he didn't know why he married me, because I was so awful. Well, and then when I think about it, I think, well, I can't hardly blame him, because I wore my hair in a pug and I didn't care about what I was just a mess, you know. But that was from him continually putting me down. It's a great struggle to find out who you are. And this is really enlightening, you know.
And who you are is continually twined up with what you've been through in the past. And you can't just sort of throw that away, because it's part of you.
Yeah.
So you leave the Catholic Church after you bounce back and forth a lot. And you say, well, you know, it's part of me. I can't just give it up, but I don't accept it. And maybe that's what I struggle with my children with.
Yeah, I think there's another complicating factor of this in my, the way I find it helpful to use this, and that is that you don't really interpret time as one-directional. So that the past is never, I was thinking, in fact, this morning up there on the tailings that about last night, and I realized that the meaning of my grandmother's life, she's been dead now for over a decade, but the meaning of her life and my grandfather's life is still in the process of being created. So that what happened last night changes what we traditionally call the past. And I think to me, that's tremendously liberating. For others, it might be very depressing to say that the past cannot be completely left behind. That's certainly un-American to say that. But I think for women especially, since we've been written out of history, to say that we our history is still there and being created all the time can be tremendously exciting. There's much more of us than we know. Were there any conversations about what this might do for understanding ourselves as sexual rather than heterosexual, homosexual, lesbian, gay, bi? Anybody talk about that in the small groups?
We mentioned that. I know this gal that we had talked about that we're on a continuation, that sexual, we're on a continuation. And one day we'll probably be, when it's the end, we'll be one spirit like God. No one worry about whether you're female or male. We'll all be one sex. So continuation. So we talked about that. I said it would be nice if we could just say sexual, but maybe we won't be able to say sexual right here, but over there we'll be able to say sexual and won't worry about it. Because it says in the Bible there's no, we won't know who are, if we've had six husbands, we won't know which is which. So we'll just all be one sex.
Interesting that you moved into that from just saying about the changing form of the cocoon into the butterfly and the beauty of moving on it.
That
thing is constantly changing. We're not here experiencing.
We're a continuation. We'll just keep going. It'll be wonderful. You know, if right here and now we could do that.
See, that's very interesting to me to hear, because I realized that as I thought about that, to say we are sexual is not to say that we are all sexual in the same way, or one sex. But to say we are sexual is to say that there is immense diversity. And so I have a friend who's blind, and she says, if I get sight in heaven, I'm going to be pissed off. She does not want to lose her characteristic identities in heaven. Because then she gets to heaven and she's not the person she was on earth. What's the point?
Yeah.
So it's two quite different ways of approaching the unity and diversity issue.
Well, I didn't mean that we would, you know, that we'd all be the same. We still have our own identity, but still we wouldn't be so concerned about the sexy, the sexual.
It could be a rather boring.
Well, there's not going to be any marriages or anything, you know.
That's what the men said in the Bible.
Yes. Did others take up this question? Oops, it's talking. Okay. Anything else? We have not any time, so there shouldn't be too much else. But go ahead.
I'm just curious, because you mentioned a couple times about there being six sexes.
Yeah, going back, to go back to the vocabulary that's used today and not this, mental apprehension of being sexed is one variable. External genitalia is a second variable. Internal reproductive organs is a third variable. And in the majority of people, there is congruence among the three, but a significant minority, there isn't. And each of these determine sex in the biological sense of being sexed, and there are six permutations of these variables. So most texts that deal with something other than heteropatriarchal stuff will talk about that, and it's very, I think it's crucial to acknowledge the diversity at that most basic of our dualisms. It is not opposite sexes. It is a configuration of six major possibilities, and then there are indeed additional variations of that. That's what I meant.
Are you talking about in utero formation of internal reproductive organs versus the hormones that then determine?
Not only in utero, but after birth. Because you can have ovaries and penis. There are people who do, and who are then either, who apprehend themselves psychologically as either male or female, which is also in part, but not wholly, a function of how they are treated by significant others, parents or others. So very often your identity is a function in our society of external genitalia. And it's created by the response you get from others. But that's a tremendous problem for people whose genitals don't match their emotional, mental, psychological apprehension of themselves as male or female. And this makes sense only from an essentialist position. And the same debate happens on question of sexual orientation, or better said, erotic orientation. Many gay men and lesbians, to some lesser degree, I think bisexuals, but not completely, will argue that from the age of three or four, they have been utterly clear about erotic preference. And therefore, preference is the wrong word. That it's orientation and is given.
But still comfortable with their self-identity as the gender that society tells them they are. So different
yes,
from someone who
yes.
says, I'm not comfortable being female.
Yes, those are two completely different issues.
Okay.
Well, I mean, nothing's completely different anymore, but those are two very distinct questions. So six sexes has nothing to do with erotic orientation or preference, so-called gay and lesbian.
Okay.
It's a whole nother issue. Odd group today. Of course, that's
what?
A terrible. What I should have said is my perception is odd today, not that you're odd. I have a request to make. We have tomorrow the sixth of these sessions, which I have purposely left unspecified as to topic. And I would like us to decide now, if we could, how will we focus this session tomorrow to be most useful to the group? We can do more specific work on this people-friendly sexual ethic in addition to the factors I've sketched out today and the ones we've talked about already. What would be helpful to you, given your expectations for the retreat?
Focus on personal issues. And it seems like that's come out a lot in small groups, is individual definitions of sexuality.
Okay, we might need a little more explanation from me on that one after this. I no longer know what the word personal or individual means.
Right.
So, but that doesn't mean it's meaningless. It means
I would say in looking more at our personal growth through this issue,
okay,
rather than looking at the church and how we work within the church.
Okay, I'm going to just jot these down. We'll check. Additional suggestions?
I'd like to, just in a practical sense, that in our evolving understanding of sexuality, if we want to teach our children and to grow ourselves, is to what would be the essential ingredients in making up a healthy sexuality for the future?
Okay.
First night, you posed a couple of questions. I think we've been talking about them ever since, but I'd like to bring it full circle and pose the questions again specifically. Who is God in a relationship, and what does cooperative power look like in sexual intercourse?
Now I can decide what's on the line.
Okay. Who decides what's going on? Any others? Speak now or forever. Isn't that an odd liturgical act, actually? Okay, is that, you will not be grossly disappointed if we discuss these four and nothing else tomorrow?
Do you have suggestions of what you offered as wrap-up sessions before that have
included? They vary depending upon the group. So what I'm trying to do right now is get your impression, and I will between now and then also give this some thought so that I'm constructed a bit. I'm not too worried about it. I will maybe. I will by tomorrow.
As someone that's just starting to use the Bible in the last few years as something to try to bring me closer to God and in a spiritual sense, is the Bible just rendered helpless in relating to this information? You know, is there no connection of spirituality in a Bible sense versus what's on the board? Are you getting what I'm saying at all?
Is God in this, or is this Jesus?
And I spoke again with some introspection. I'll probably have to do that myself.
I think it's important to pose the questions as we understand the questions. Any others? I heard the question, is God in this? That's related to who is God in a relationship. Okay, any others? I'm not going to push this too much. I just want to make sure that everybody is happy. That's my job as a woman. I'm reminded of the video, remember? What she said about when women transform into men? And learn how hard it is to learn how to act as a man in that video that night. And one of the things is that women always are smiling and making sure that everybody's young.
Everybody's happy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And think about between now and tomorrow, how often you do that conversation. Just the facial expression of women that sort of make sure that everybody's happy. Okay, we're over time. The day beckons, and Gaia has provided it, so we would do her ill to ignore it, I think. So we will have tomorrow morning session when it happens, and in the interim, rejoice and be exceeding glad. I think.